This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. Earlier this week, we heard about the effectiveness of one Milwaukee-based organization in helping the quality of life for AIDS patients. The strength of the work of the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin lies in its so-called medical home model, in which a variety of services, from medical care to pharmacy to mental health support, are provided under one roof. But reaching and helping people with HIV and AIDS can be especially challenging when we're talking about the homeless population. In recent years, a variety of supporting housing programs have evolved in an effort to help homeless people live longer, healthier lives with HIV. But little is known about how well those programs work. Two Milwaukee researchers are hoping to find the answers. Julia Dixon Gomez and Stephen Pinkerton are scientists with the Center for AIDS Intervention Research and are recipients of a multimillion-dollar federal grant to study housing, homelessness, and AIDS. The two joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in the studio, and Dickinson Gomez explained what we already know about the link between homelessness and AIDS.
One thing we know is that the homeless are about 16 times more likely to become infected with HIV than people who are not homeless. We also know that among people who are already infected with HIV, about half of them have reported housing needs. We know that those who are homeless have a harder time getting access and linked into medical care. They have a poorer adherence to antiretroviral medicines, which help them live longer.
And is part of that because of their housing situation?
Most definitely. I mean, it's hard to keep track of pills when you're moving from place to place. It's harder. Just the general life is a little bit chaotic. Also, I think sometimes there's still stigma and a lot of people want to hide taking medication. That's harder to do if you're in a shelter or if you're kind of temporarily doubling up with another drug-using acquaintance, for example.
And you mentioned drug use, and the homeless population isn't just impacted with HIV, but there are other issues that are wrapped up with this too, right?
Yeah. I mean, the study that was just funded, which is actually my third study on housing / homelessness and HIV, this is a project that's going to be looking at supportive housing programs, which are designed for a particular segment of the homeless population, what is generally considered the chronically homeless. In order to be eligible for the subsidies for supportive housing programs, generally people receive shelter plus care subsidies, which means you have one of three qualifying conditions. So you're HIV positive, you have substance use disorder or severe mental illness. Oftentimes they have a couple or all three. The chronically homeless is actually defined as people who have been homeless for a period longer than a year or for people who've had multiple periods of homelessness in the last 3 years. So these are kind of, for want of a better word, kind of the more severe end of the spectrum of homelessness.
And maybe this is an obvious question, but what are the challenges in studying these issues and this population? This is not always an easy population to quantify, right?
Not so much if they're housed, and that's hopefully going to be the case in this study. In the previous two studies, we were actually looking at people in a variety of housing situations, but all low income. And yes, the homeless are hard to track. They have often transient work, so they'll be gone for a season. They often end up in jail, unfortunately, or the hospital. So we have pretty good retention rates, but the previous studies were in Hartford, Connecticut as well, which is a small city. So we knew where to look for them, and if we couldn't find them, we generally figured they weren't there and that they would eventually show up. So sometimes we had longitudinal studies where we would track them at 6 and 12 months. Sometimes when we couldn't find them at 6 months, we could at 12. So,
Steven Pinkerton, why is this work the purview of psychiatry and behavioral medicine?
Well, I think the link there are two pieces to it that go together. One is related to the fact that HIV does have effects on the brain. So very early on, that was one link between the study of HIV and mental health, in particular the National Institute of Mental Health at NIH began to fund these studies. The other obvious link is that HIV is behaviorally transmitted, and even now as we have more effective treatments, behavior plays an important role in making sure people actually take those treatments, attend their medical appointments, etc. So HIV is very much a behavioral disease that also has important neurological impacts.
What are the different kinds of housing models that you're studying? Because that's I guess, the key question you're asking in this latest work is the effectiveness of these various models. What are the types of models that exist?
Most of this comes under the umbrella of supportive housing. And a lot of it was modeled from a program in New York called Pathways to Housing. Now, this was a different kind of model. This kind of model they call housing first. So the idea is that whatever their problems are in terms of mental illness or substance use, it's important first to get them housed before they can try to address these other issues. Prior to that, they had kind of continuum of care models where people had to go through drug treatment or mental health treatment, maybe spend some time in halfway houses and go through all these hoops before they were eligible for permanent housing. So supportive housing is permanent supportive housing. And so the Pathways model was definitely a harm reduction approach. Come as you are. You have the right to accept any kind of services. These programs are usually linked with services, at a minimum, case management to help with daily living.
And these are typically under the same roof?
No, not necessarily. They have both project-based and scattered sites. So project-based is under one roof. Scattered site, you get a housing voucher, much like a housing choice voucher, which used to be known as Section 8. And you get to choose your own apartment. So it's kind of the idea like free market rental housing, except that people in the agency often intervene and have close relationships with landlords to make it easier for people to rent because they don't have the best credit histories. They often have incarceration histories. So, I mean, that's one of the differences in the models. I think originally the Pathways to Housing model was very much consumer choice. So the idea was that people would get vouchers and have a choice in where to live. In practice, it doesn't always happen like that. Sometimes it's an active choice. It's much easier to provide services under one roof. All the services that residents might need. On the other hand, they lose a sense of autonomy and choice. On the other hand, in practice, sometimes because demand so outmatches or the need so outmatches the actual supply of supportive housing, in reality, people may not have that much choice at all. I think what may happen in practice is that people are on a waiting list and then they take what they can get, which may or may not be the best match. And of course, there are all sorts of other issues that probably play into the decision about where and what kind of housing to provide. There are, the reactions from neighbors. There are funding constraints. And so I think this is the first study, to my knowledge, where we can really look at a place that has a significant number of supportive housing units because Chicago and Illinois in general, but particularly Chicago, has been one of the forerunners in the supportive housing movement, and take a look at how all these different factors affect the kinds of housing that are provided.
Does that mean that the current approach to housing as a factor in preventing and treating HIV has largely been guided through theory or hunches to this point?
More or less. I mean, there have been there has been studies that have shown a definite link between improvements in housing status and improvements in health and decreases in emergency room visits for those living with HIV and decreases in sexual and drug injection risks for those who are not yet positive. But Chicago was actually one of the first sites where they did a randomized control trial. They had people who were homeless and they randomized them to immediate supportive housing or wait list control. And in their intent to treat analysis, you know, just comparing those in the two conditions, regardless of what their housing status became, they found some not significant findings, but definite trends. But what had happened actually is that half of the people in the waitlist control achieved housing because they were getting all sorts of caseworker help in obtaining housing. So when you look at actually the people who were not getting housing and those who were and did that comparison, there were definite significant differences in terms of health outcomes and risk behavior. And I think we're pretty convinced that, yes, housing works. The question, though, is which model of housing works the best and for what kind of resident and how much do they cost, which is where Steve comes in.
We're interested not only in the benefits that can be achieved, but at what cost. Obviously, these programs are not free. However, in addition to providing housing to people who otherwise would be unstably housed, they also have a lot of societal benefits. Julia already mentioned the fact that we'd expect to see fewer hospitalizations, fewer emergency room visits, hopefully less incarceration. There are a number of societal benefits that we'd like to capture the cost of to see, in fact, whether these programs pay for themselves. And maybe more importantly and more in line with the rest of the project, we'd like to look at what factors drive that. Is it a particular model of supportive housing? Is it whether or not things are clustered versus scattered site? What are those factors that affect the cost? And overall, is the cost beneficial? Does it actually pay for itself? Is it cost saving?
And presumably this is the kind of data that housing agencies or public health units of government or policymakers can take when they're actually trying to shape what housing for this population should look like in a particular community.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, this National AIDS Housing Coalition and the research summit that they do, they have been very interested in cost-benefit analyses and cost-effectiveness. And there have been a number of studies that have done that have shown that, yes, housing is cost-effective. But this question of which model is, again, kind of up in the air.
Well, but presumably maybe at the end of this five-year period, a little less up in the air.
We hope to tease it apart, but
we
it is very complicated. You've got personal, individual factors. You've got factors at the housing level. There are a number of variables to take into account.
We'll learn. I'm confident we'll learn some things.
Yes.
Well, hopefully in the years down the road, we can have you back and talk about what you're learning.
Sure.
Be
my pleasure.
Julia Dixon Gomez and Stephen Pinkerton, thank you so much to both of you and best of luck with your work.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Julia Dixon Gomez and Steve Pinkerton are professors of psychiatry and behavioral medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin and are researchers with the Center for AIDS Intervention Research. They are recipients of a five-year, $3.1 million grant from the National Institutes of Health to study housing models for homeless people with AIDS. They spoke with Mitch Teich.